And he was teaching me. He was teaching me, like, how to do mantra. I said to him, gee, I've got this beautiful mala. And I wore it, you know, like beads. And he took it off from my neck and he held it and he... Formless all, Mane, the jewel, Padme, the unfolding lotus, Hung, the realization in form, or Aum, the formless, Hung, the heart, or Padme, the opening senses. So it's Aum, the unformed, is like a jewel in the center of the unfolding lotus, and it resides in your heart. Om Mane Padme Hum. And the Hum has got to be pronounced with the nose closed. And it's got to resonate in the middle of the heart, in what's called the heart cave, in the Hridayam, which is right here, not over here. It's a little to the right of the sternum. And it's Hum, Hum. Om and Aum, Om, spelt in the in English, O-M is pronounced as if it were spelled A-U-M, and it starts, it's all the sounds of the universe, and it starts at the back of the mouth and moves forward to the front. So it's Aum, 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 Aum Mani Padme Hum. That's the Tibetan translation. And he gave that to me, and he did that for a number of hours with me. And then he took, gave me the mala, and he took the mala, and we did it together for hours. Now, this is not for minutes, for hours. And then he left me, and I kept doing it. And then it came nighttime, and I got into bed, and I lay down, and I closed my eyes, and suddenly I heard like a chorus of thousands and thousands of these deep, deep voices. Aum Mani Padme Hum, Aum Mani Padme Hum. And it was as if I was hearing voices over time. I mean, it's what's called the Omkar, or the universal sound of Om. I had tuned in on the sound of the universe, and this was my vehicle to do it. I had done that, and I had tuned in on this place where that sound is. And it was a very real sound for me. And what I realized after a while with this fellow was that the mantra was always going on in him. For example, now that I've been working very hard all year, all the time I'm talking to you, this is very hard for you to appreciate because I can't do two things at once, but Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani, is going on inside of me. And when I stop for a moment, I just go back into that, and then I come out again. And it's a place in the center, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. So he's training me what I can eat. Like I say, gee, I'd love some scrambled eggs. No eggs. You know, the thing that bothers me about India is you can't get a good steak. No steak.
Gee, I'm hungry. Well, you already had a meal today. Just slowly, I mean, subtle little things he was training me on. And you'd go to a rest house, and there would be a wooden table without this nice soft carpet, and that would be the place you'd sleep. And so after a few weeks of this, my feet were covered with blisters, my hip bones were all black and blue, my stomach, I get this terrible dysentery, see, and our first aid kit was a package of Band-Aids and a tube of Johnson first aid cream. And I get this terrible dysentery, and I'd say, oh, if I only had Enter-Viaform, he'd say, just fast for a few days, you've got to develop the bacteria to be able to handle it. Don't worry about it, you know. And in the presence of him, what could I do? I mean, you know, if I was hungry, here was a guy 6'7" who was eating less than I was eating. And healthy and vital and a beautiful musician, a master musician, master musician. And he'd walk down the, well, we would walk down the street, of course, and we were in the name of the game, we were holy men, we were sadhus in India. Well, now around cities in India, sadhus is getting to be a dirty word because it upsets the economy to have 10 million hippies hanging around, 10 million dropouts hanging around in India, not earning their keep. In the villages, they are still treated with much reverence, and you'd walk through a village and people would rush out to touch your feet. And that, of course, freaked me completely because I was just a Westerner on, you know, who happened to be dressed, you know, going barefoot, but I didn't, you know. Once we stopped at Baneshwar at these Buddhist caves to meditate, and I found a little cave, and I went in, and I sat down, and I got very calm, and I closed my eyes, and I went into a reverie, I'd say, for maybe 15 or 20 minutes, and I woke up, and I looked ahead of me, and by the door, it was very dark in the cave, there was a little pile, I thought there were pebbles. Maybe I had stepped over, because I wasn't dark-adapted when I walked. Looked closer, and they were coins. Some pilgrims had come along, and they'd seen this holy man meditating, and because in India, the grusta, the householder, part of his spiritual responsibility is to provide for the holy man. You know, I was finding that it paid to be a holy man, that it was like... I quickly gave the money away, you know. It was upsetting me because I wasn't who they thought I was. But he told me, he said, look, he said, when somebody blesses you, and you can't bend over and touch them because it's inappropriate for sadhu to do that, to touch their feet. But you can do it in your heart to them. And they're getting the blessing from doing that. That's a spiritual act from them. And you can complete the energy cycle by doing it in your heart back to them. So you bless everybody that blesses you. So it's all right. He has to get an annual, he's a resident, he's got a resident visa. So he said to me, we will have to go and see my guru. This was the first time he had ever mentioned having a guru. And he says, I think what we ought to do is go to Harish and borrow the Land Rover to go up into the mountains because it'll save time and we only have a few days till the visa expires. Well, the Land Rover is a $6,500 car, and in India it's probably the most valuable car in India. Because you hardly see cars, they're all taxis, most of them. Very few people have private cars outside of the main cities. And this was a possession which I didn't want. I mean, I had finished with possessions. I was very happy now with my shoulder bag. I didn't want all this possession. However, he wanted it. And so, okay, we'll go in the Rover, although it was bugging me to do that. And I knew that Harish really didn't want to give it to us. He was enjoying it too much. Cause, you know, he was enjoying having this car. But we went, I said, Harish isn't going to give it to us, and Bhagwan Das said, he'll give it to us. We went, and an hour later, we had the car, and we were on our way. But I was bugged, and I was sort of irritated inside. Right? All the way up into the mountains, I was irritated. And I was still smoking hashish, and I've been smoking it for 4 months steadily, and that was not helping my irritation at all, because after a while, it gets you very brittle. And we went up and up, and as we got closer, I realized that something very special was going to happen, because Bhagwan Das, who was usually very calm, was starting to show tremendous signs of emotion, and tears were streaming down his face, and I felt he was getting very excited about getting close to his guru. He had never even mentioned having a guru before, and I didn't even know what kind of a guru it was going to be. what sect or anything. Now, the night before we went to see the guru, I must tell you this, that around 2 a.m, I had to go to the bathroom, and I went outside, and I was looking up at the stars, and I was thinking about my mother. Now, I left for India in April, in May, end of May, and my mother had died in January. She had died in Boston, and she had died of a blood condition, an over-enlarged spleen and so on. And I wasn't thinking about her death. I had not thought about her death in India. I had thought a lot about her, but about her life and about spiritual things. I had never talked about her to anybody in India. I thought about her that night, and then I went back to bed. All right, now the next day we're in the rover and we're going up to the mountains and we come to this little temple by the side of the road, and I think we're just slowing down to let a truck pass, but we stop because there's nothing there but a little temple. And people surround the car lovingly toward this fellow I'm with, and he says, "Where's the guru?" And they point, he's up on a hill. And he goes loping off up this hill, and I'm running behind, and I'm like really bugged now. I mean, I'm being ignored. And after all, he's 23 years old, and I'm, you know, 36 at the time. And the Land Rover's bugging me, and the hashish is bugging me, and I'm just in really bad state, right? And I'm climbing, running up the hill behind him. And when we get to the top of the hill, there is a man sitting with a blanket wrapped around him. Actually, this blanket. And about 10 people, Hindus, are sitting around him. And the fellow I'm with falls flat out in Danda Pranam, in honor, touches the feet of this man who is smiling at him, and I'm standing by, you know, like, what are you supposed to do? You know? I don't know what to do, feeling very sort of uncomfortable. Sort of trying to be out of the way so I don't exist. This man looks up at me, and he says to Bhagwan Das, he said, "Have you got a picture of me?" Bhagwan Das says, "Yes." He says, "Give it to him," meaning me. Bhagwan Das says, "I will." Then he says to me, "You came in a good car?" Now this is in Hindi, only half of which I understand, and there's a translator who's translating along the way, so that together I'm getting the expression. I said, "Yes." He says, "You give it to me?" Oh, wow, you know. So I said, "Well, He says, "You don't like the car?" "It's worth much? Maybe you can get one for me like it?" Well, perhaps. I don't know what's happening. All I feel is I'm being hustled in a way I don't understand at all. And then a few minutes later, he says to me, "You were out of the stars last night." Now I was. You've got to understand, I was 100 miles away the night before. "Yes? Acha. You were thinking about your mother. Acha. She died last year. Acha. She got very big in the belly before she died. She died of spleen. Now, to describe what happened to me at that moment, the only metaphor I can use is what happens when a computer is fed an insoluble problem. I mean, I am a rational social scientist, and all the time when people tell me about mystical experiences, it's great, but it happened to you, not me. And people who are having all these other things, and when I've had these weird things under drugs, in my head there's a category of stuff filled with events that happened under drugs, but after all, it happened under drugs, and I was the observer, and I was under drugs too, so how do I know I didn't, you know? I wasn't, you know, this wasn't the hashish. And my mind reached for every, like, could anybody have told him? How would he know? You know, and there was no possible way that I could think of at that moment, or have I ever thought of since, that he could know that. I mean, this is a man, you know, probably he's in his 70s, Hindi, sitting up on a hill, there's no communication, no telephones, no nothing. I'm just a passenger in a car. I haven't even been thinking about how my mother died, so it's not even in my thoughts. It's not like the uppermost thing in my head. My mind went through all the possible possibilities, like a computer just flip, 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 flip. This, the, you know, it searched in that storage unit, it searched in this storage unit, this storage unit. And finally it does what a computer does when it can't solve a problem. You know, the red light goes on and the bell sounds and the machine stops. And I experienced my mind stopping. It just broke down. My rational mind just couldn't handle the data. And simultaneously, he was looking at me, and I was looking into his eyes, and I felt this extraordinary wrenching in my heart, and I started to cry. And I didn't cry because I was unhappy, and I didn't cry because I was happy. It was just like a flood of tears poured out. And I cried and cried and cried. The closest I can describe it, it's as if I was home. It's as if, yeah, right. Whew. Because what I intuitively understood was that I had met someone who knew. If you understand what I mean, I had met somebody whose consciousness, who was a living being who represented this other state of consciousness. I never left that temple again. In fact, I'm literally still there. That evening, I went back, I was taken to another temple about 12 miles away. And I was very emotional, very confused, very emotional. I didn't understand what he had done or why he had done it or what it all meant or anything. I mean, I just didn't, it was just all, no, I couldn't figure it out, in my old term of figure it out. But it felt awful good. And that evening, it crossed my mind that, gee, I was unpacking and I saw this bottle of LSD and I wondered, you know, I've always wondered what LSD is, and here's a man who knows. I mean, he really knows. Because I realized that in order to know what he knew about that spleen, he had to be able to transcend time and space in his consciousness. And therefore, he must know all kinds of things. He'd know what LSD was, and I really must ask him, I thought. The next morning, I was called for and taken to the guru by very loving sadhus, who all treated me like I was a brother who would come home, by the way. I mean, very strange feeling there. And I go up to him and he says, Now I have no trouble at all touching his feet. I mean, listen, I'm, you know, honored to be able to do it. It's just the feeling is entirely different. He says, where's the medicine? Now, the first thing he says to me is, have you any questions? He says, have you got a question? My mind was blank. I was just in complete bliss. No, I don't have any questions. You know, I'm just happy to be here. It's a groove. Where's the medicine? What, medicine? Any medicine? Johnson First Aid Cream? I don't know. So Bhagwan Das says to me, he means the LSD. Oh, the LSD. It's in the car. Bring the medicine. Okay. Go and I bring the bottle of pills. Pour them out in my hand. What's that? I've got a little of everything in there. So, LSD and a few STP and some energizers and tranquilizers and an old sleeping pill with some mold on it. And, you know, just the things you carry along with you for any occasion. What's that? What's that? What's that? What's that? So I tell him what each thing is. He says, does it give you any siddhis? Somebody says, it means powers. So I thought he meant, being a Westerner, here's an old man who wants physical vitality. He wants powers, see? So I said, no, it's not. I wish I had vitamins for you, but these aren't them. So I put them all back in the bottle, figuring he's disappointed. What he wanted was some vitamin pills. He must be feeling weak. You know, and I'm a little disappointed. See? And he holds out his hand, so I pour out one white lightning. That's a very pure LSD pill that is about 300 micrograms. It's 305 exactly, which is a very powerful dose. So I pour a second one. I pour a third one. Now in his hand, he is holding 900 micrograms of very pure LSD. Looks and he goes, okay. Swallows it. I watch it go down his throat. I mean, I really see it go down. So the scientist in me thinks, well, this is going to be interesting. And I settle back at the edge of the crowd to wait. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. All day, nothing happened. He's already there. There's nothing to happen. The week before, a sadhu who takes arsenic, if you take arsenic in very small doses, it's very good for singing bhajan. If you take it in large doses, it's something else. But he had his year's supply, which was enough to kill 10 men. And he was carrying it, and the guru said, you take arsenic. Let me see the arsenic. He took the thing, the block of it, put it in his mouth, chewed it up, and swallowed it. And everybody started to cry, don't leave us. And they wanted to pump his stomach and, you know, the whole thing. And he was just sitting there smiling and nothing happened. That evening when I was back, the evening after that, I was back at my place, and I was thinking, gee, if I'm going to stay around here, one of these days I ought to take a bus and go over and see Lama Govinda, because Lama Govinda is one of the leading interpreters for the West of Tibetan Buddhism, and he's over in Almora, and it would be interesting to see him. We get dedicated our book to him. One of the people we dedicated the book to, and I haven't met him, and Tim's seen him, and Ralph's seen him, and so on. thought about that. The next morning, 8 o'clock, car there with a chauffeur, orders to take me to see Lama Govinda. Four months later, the first time I left the ashram, the temple, I had to go to Delhi about extending my airplane ticket and public health stuff and all that kind of jazz, money problems. I had given a lot of money to some Tibetans and I had to cash traveler's checks. And I went to Delhi, and by then I was in a different state, as you'll hear later on today. And I did all my business, and then in the afternoon, I decided I'd treat myself. I had been on a very severe regimen, as we will talk about. Went into a restaurant, and I had a vegetarian meal, and then I had ice cream and two biscuits, which was quite a luxury for me. And then I went to the Buddhist mission I was staying at outside of Delhi, and then the next day I got up at 5:30 and I took the bus back and went up to the mountains. And the guru had been up further in the mountains, and a few days later he arrived back, and everybody, the guru's here, and we all jump onto the public buses and rush to the guru. And I go rushing up to him, and I'm just, it's like coming to the sunshine. I mean, that's the feeling you have. And I brought him oranges, and I, you know, fell at his feet, and he was taking the oranges and eating them. It was like a sign of love. And I had my head down, and he grabbed my hair, and he pulled it back, and he looked at me, and he said, "How'd you like the biscuits?" From the moment I met the guru until I left for America, they completely took over my life. In other words, I experienced what I later guess I would call surrender.
WBAI, New York.
But it was just the way it says in the books. It was surrender that is no surrender. I mean, how can you surrender to this? It's like, it's so beyond that, so beyond that. What are you giving up? And this other fellow and I are the only Westerners that are connected with this scene at all that I know of. And it's very quiet and modest. The guru only owns, he owns nothing. He has a blanket. He wears a blanket. And he gave me this, and I gave him another blanket. And his devotees take care of him. And they protect him for themselves. Because if they leave him, he'll just walk off into the woods and they'll never see him again. He is in what is known as Sahaja Samadhi. That is, he is in a state of full consciousness in the body, all times, at all times. There is yet one more very special being I wish to introduce you to. His name is Baba Haridas. By the way, my name is Baba Ramdas now. The guru gave me this name. And when I was sent to America, I was told that Richard Alpert wasn't going to America, that Baba Ramdas was. Baba means grandfather. It is also a title meaning holy man that is used in the Vaishnavite sects in the same way that Swami is used in the Shaivite sects. Ram is one of the incarnations of Vishnu, who is one of the three manifest forms of Brahman, or the unmanifest beyond it all. And Das means servant, and therefore it means servant of God. Now, Baba Haridas was my teacher. He was a man. This is not the guru. This is my teacher now. This is a disciple of the gurus. He is a Brahmin of the Brahmin caste from southern India. At 8 years old, he left his family and went into the jungle as a jungle sadhu. These are all jungle sadhus. The guru spent maybe 40, 50 years in the jungle, alone in the jungle.
Baba Haridas went into, left home at 8, and when he became my teacher, he is 48 years old. He met the guru 15 years ago and has served him ever since. They are in a relationship that you would call complementary, I would say. Haridas Baba is very high, and he has many devotees that for whom he is a guru. He has been mauna, that is silent, for 15 years. I was silent all the time I was at the ashram. I spoke with a chalkboard. He reads and writes 8 languages. 8 different languages, not just different dialects, different languages. And taught me in English, very fluent English. When people give gifts to the guru for building temples and so on, Haridas Baba does all the architectural designing of these buildings, hires all the workmen, supervises all the building, handles all the finances, all the payment, runs all the temples, sleeps 2 hours a night. His total food intake for 15 years is 2 glasses of milk a day. Bas. Period. Weighs 90 pounds. And when the workman can't lift a particularly heavy rock, very special person, very, very much, much light, much light. There's an expression called Tej, which is light. It's a light that comes out of the face. And these people I lived with all had much Tej, much of that, that prana coming out from their face, much light. Now, one of the reasons they have so much light is because the sect I was living with and I am now part of are all brahmachari, which means they are continent. Now, I'd like to make the distinction between celibacy as practiced in Western religions and brahmachari as practiced in this sect. Celibacy is really the suppression of sexual expression. Brahmachari is the process of redirecting the energy for a spiritual purpose. It is what is called the conversion of Bindu to Ojas. And Bindu is energy, which is it's the form in which prana takes when it is in energy in the lower centers of the body, which one then uses as sexual energy. And the conversion of this up into the energy which is resides in the upper chakras and is for the purpose of spiritual work, that energy is a much finer type of energy, and it's called ojas. And a man who has been continent for many, many years and has practiced something like pranayama, which we'll talk about in a minute, for converting this energy, has stored a great deal of this ojas and has much to work with. And you can tell it by that kind of light that emanates from their face. And it gives them considerable powers to work with. I mean, whatever we might say about Maharishi Mahesh and his attachment to worldly things and his limits as a spiritual guide for the West, and there is no doubt that he is attached. Nevertheless, he has been brahmachari for some 50 years and has much power. He would have to have had that power to have been able to create the even a passing thing like he did. Now, when it was first suggested to me by Bhagwan Das, that Bhagwan Das was the traveling companion. Bhagwan is a name of God, and Das is servant again. And I'll talk about the servant role in a few minutes. When Bhagwan Das first said to me, I'm a brahmachari, and he explained what it was, and he said he thought that's what I should do, I found that pretty humorous. Having been in a Freudian analysis, and taken much delight in my, much delight in my sexual life.
The thought of, as a Westerner, the thought of giving up sex just seemed absurd to me. And I said, well, you're not expecting me to do that. And that's just out of the question. And he looked at me with infinite compassion and said no more about it. Later, he said about something else, now, what everything you do is important. Later, none of it will matter. In other words, at the stage you're at, in the stage of purification, or in the stage of mobilizing and directing the energies of your body, everything you do is relevant to your spiritual journey. Later on, when you have become clearly centered in that place, when you are in a state where you don't need to depend on your work to keep you there, then nothing will matter. You can do everything. Then you can have whatever sex you want. But you see, the paradox of the game, ladies and gentlemen, is what the deal you're being offered is. You can have all of your desires, any desire you've ever dreamed of having. You will have all of your desires fulfilled just as soon as you give up all desire. Yeah. It's very simple. You can have it all. You can have it all. All the power you wanted, all the fame you wanted, all the sexual gratification you wanted, the money, anything you want. You name it. You name it. But you can't desire it. Therefore, the path is the path of total renunciation. You don't renounce the act. That would be hypocrisy, to renounce the act and still desire it. You renounce the desire for the act. That's the key. The renunciation of the desire for the act. See, in other words, well, you understand that. As my teacher wrote on his chalkboard, desire is a trap. Desirelessness is moksha, liberation. Desire is the creator. Desire is the destroyer. Desire is the universe. And when you reflect on it, you can see how your desires create the world in which you live. And in psychological terms, you can say motivation affects perception. It's the same statement. The only thing is that in psychology, all you can do is trade one motive for another, because the models don't allow for the possibility of being somebody that has transcended desire. There isn't that place in the psychological theoretical design of man. That the theories of psychology do not allow for the possibility that man could exist in a desireless state, you see. The closest they get are dealing with what they call needs and drives, which are social drives and physiological needs. And they'll allow that you can get along without minimized social drives, but when they get to physiological needs, they're just, it's too powerful for them to think about. And when you have met a yogi, as I have, who has been buried alive for 3 years, where, as he explained it to me, the only oxygen he needed was that necessary to feed his brain cells and his heart muscle. And the only error they made was they didn't pack his right arm well enough, so the ants ate it all away. And his cells of his body stored the oxygen that was necessary for this purpose. Then you come back to psychology, and the physiological psychologist talking about the need for oxygen. And then you meet Haridas Baba, who drinks 2 glasses of milk a day, and you read the Public Health, World Health Organization folders, and this man is dead. There's no doubt about it. He's dead. He can't survive. He's got rickets, scurvy, and he's dead. But there he is, lifting big rocks, running up and down hills, sleeping 2 hours a night, full of light and energy. It pushes your Western security that we really know, you know, just a little bit. Now, brahmachari is one of the 5 categories of yama, which is one of the 8 legs of Ashtanga Yoga, which is called 8-legged yoga. It's also known in the West as Raja Yoga. Some of you, I suspect, have seen Vivekananda's book or the Isherwood Prabhavananda book called How to Know God. There are a number of these books. The interesting thing for me was that I had been in Wisner's bookstore down in the basement, and I had found Vivekananda's Raja Yoga, and I had bought it in 1962, taken it home, and started to read it. And it just, I didn't like his looks, you know. He was kind of fat, and he looked kind of like, I don't know, he didn't turn me on. And I just figured, well, you know, it would be one thing. I was such a phony. I mean, If Aldous Huxley had said to me, Dick, you really ought to read Vivekananda's book, I would have read that until I understood it, because, you know, some important person had told me to do it. But because I found it in the basement of Wiseman's bookstore, it was dusty, and I, you know, I read it. And when I ran up the obstacle of not liking his face, and it was all in there, you see. Everything I needed to know was in there. But see, I wasn't ready to see it. That was about it. There, you have to get to the point where you begin to understand what this readiness to see or readiness to hear. You know, what does it mean that we are gathered together, that I can say this and that you can hear it? You know, what does that say about all of us? Who are we? Now, Haridas Baba was such a subtle teacher that I never realized for almost 3 months that he was teaching me Ashtanga Yoga. Because he was teaching it to me, I was an educational psychologist, and therefore I understand theories of education, learning, rather. And I've worked in elementary schools and junior high schools, and no matter how subtle any teaching techniques I've ever seen, I've never seen one like this. Because he taught it from inside me. It was just emerging out of me. There would be just the slightest felt need on my part for something, and then the next chapter would be there. And when I remember one night talking a lot, I mean writing a lot, and I said, I'm sorry, I had so much to say. He said, I made you. Right. Now, Ashtanga Yoga, the eight-legged, eight-armed yoga, consists of yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. The last four, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, are all concerned with, well, except for samadhi, are concerned with meditation. And samadhi is the final state in which it all comes together. The first two, yama and niyama, are concerned with purification and getting yourself straight. Now, I used to say, when I was lecturing, the year before I went to India, I used to go around and people would say, gee, why do we always come down? I used to say, well, the problem is, I feel in myself, I'm not straight enough yet. I've got to get things straight. And I, being a psychologist, would say to people, you've got to get your human contract straight. That means if you've left bad vibrations behind you because you walked out on your parents or you walked out on a chick and the baby or you quit a job, or you've done something that left bad vibrations, you've got to go and straighten all that out, because it brings you down, because those vibrations are around all the time. That was the closest I could get to what purification meant. Now I'll tell you a little more about the 10 components of yama and niyama that make up purification. Asana is concerned with, which is the third of the eight legs, is concerned with this is an asana. This is, well, the traditional one you know of is the lotus position, or padmasana, where the feet are up on the thighs. And hatha yoga is the way in which we think in the West of that component of yoga concerned with the body. Primarily, asanas are used in Raja Yoga or Ashtanga Yoga in order to get your body into, it's used to purify the nerves, to open the nerves, and it's used for the endocrine system, and it's used in order to allow you to be able to sit like this for long times, because when you do meditation, you have to be able to find a seat where you're not, you know, moving around for maybe 6, 8, 10 hours. And this, where your body is forming a triangle on the floor, is a one. Finally, when you've mastered it, you can sit there indefinitely. It just doesn't matter. And so a lot of the asanas that I do every day are for to get your body able to do this and for the nerves, which I'll tell you more about later. The fourth one is pranayama, which is controlling the prana, or that is the energy system in your body. Now, there are two components that you've got to work with. One is the energy system, and the other is the direction of the energy. You can think of it like a laser beam. The game is, if I can define it in game terms, the game is to get control of the energy in your body and start to direct it and release a great deal of energy that you only know about when you take drugs for most of the people in the West, because it's usually closed off completely. To control that energy, and then through meditation techniques to be able to direct the energy. And then the game is, as meditation, as we'll see when we talk about meditation, is to make the mind one-pointed, that is, narrow the beam down till it's directed, so you can completely direct it against one point, and then turn it back on itself. And then go through and out. This is, I mean, I'm giving you the simplest kind of visual description of what the process is. Now, so pranayama is the energy control, and it, let me tell you in the in the simplest terms, it has completely blown my mind, pranayama. It is just extraordinary, really extraordinary. It's very exacting and delicate work, but it is quite extraordinary. And I will, before the afternoon's up, give you some of the basic breathing things that are preliminary to it that are extremely good even in one's daily life when one is living as a grusta, as a householder out in the world. Then there is pratyahara, the meditation ones at the end, and finally samadhi, and different levels of samadhi, which we'll talk about later on. Now, yama, which is the first of the purification categories, consists of brahmachari, which I've already talked about, or sexual continence. That means holding your sexual energy for other purposes. Now, this is really involved with the control of the muladhara, the first chakra, and just redirecting the energy. Almost all Westerners, or all people, have available all of their energy in usually the first three chakras, the one of which is right at the stomach point, one is below the navel, and the third is like the three nerves right at the halfway between the genitals and the anal sphincter, right in the middle there. And the energy is used for action, for sex, for eating, for things like that, for rajas-type activities. And the process of taking that energy and moving it up the spine is what we will be talking about when we talk about pranayama. Now, the second of the five categories of yama is, these aren't ordered particularly, there is truthfulness. Now, it's a very funny thing what's happened to us in the West about truthfulness. We have developed what we would call the socially expedient selective report, which is, I mean, what I said to you at the beginning, I really meant, I have got to be able to tell you everything. In other words, I have got to be able to give you unqualified truth, so there is no question you can ask me that I have not got to be able to answer, because there's nowhere to hide in that sense. And any time you start to do any kind of distortion of truth, you pull yourself further and further and further into a separate, trapping yourself in that separate package, which is the game you're trying to get out of, the thing you're trying to get out of. You can't afford dishonesty, is the way it works out. You just can't afford it. It's just too costly. Now, I recall two incidents in the West which are very relevant here. One was when I was a professor at Stanford. And all the psychology introductory students had to serve in experiments. And deception was used as part of these experiments. A student would be told, this thing you do on this will count on your grade, it's very important, because they wanted to create stress. Then at the end they'd say, it was all, we were only kidding. We're psychologists, you know, and sorry. Now, I was giving this course, and there were 500 students in it, and I was told to make an announcement saying that an important, they all had to come to a certain place, and they would all be given a test, and it would affect their grade. And I said, well, it won't affect their grade. And the man that gave me the paper, this boy, this graduate student, said, I know, but you've got to say it, because we've got to create the stress. I said, well, I'm their professor. You can't ask me to lie to them. So he went back and told his professor, who was a big wheel in the department. I was an acting instructor, and this other guy was a full professor. Full professor came and said, I'll take all the responsibility. I said, I don't care whether you'll take all the responsibility or not. I'm the teacher in this course. He says, well, we'll see about that. So off we marched to the chairman of the department. Chairman of the department said, well, Dick, don't you think you're being a bit naive? I said, no, I don't think I'm being a bit naive. But now you see the game had changed. Now it wasn't just me against the professor. It was my job and career and future. I mean, I was suddenly, you know, a civil liberties case, and a few minutes before I had just... So the chairman said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll make the announcement. You just introduce me. Can you imagine the chairman of the department is going to come in and lie because the head of the, right? So I said, okay. See, I sold out at that point, right? I found my way, I copped out, which I did many times in the course of being a psychologist because it was the zeitgeist. Everybody was doing it. It was the thing. How are we supposed to get data if we don't create those conditions, right? And I was being treated as some naive fool. Now, the other experience I had, before I went to India, I was with a group of hippies from San Francisco and Los Angeles, and we were in Wata Villa in Arizona with the Hopi Indian elders. We were trying to arrange for a Hopi hippie bean, right? And there were 20 or 30 of us had come down, and I was traveling with this girl Caroline in a bus that I had, a big school bus, and we had come by, and there was this Sunday morning meeting. I remember it very well. It was in a Hopi hut, and around this table were sitting men, the youngest of whom was 60, and they probably ranged to about 105, you know, and they were just beautiful men, just beautiful. And the youngster of the group, of the man in middle age, was explaining an incident that they were dealing with, and he said that one of the young Hopis had been driving a truck, and the truck had been in an accident with one of the Bureau of Indian Affairs government cars, which had five government men in it. And it was not the Indian boy's fault. And the next day, the police came along and they found a liquor bottle in the gutter, and they said that the boy had been drinking, right? And then he looked at me and he said, the boy had not been drinking, he spoke truth. Right? And the way he said that, I realized that in their culture, in the world he lived in, it was still the world where you asked a person and they told you the truth, and there weren't contracts, and there wasn't doubt, well, is he really telling the truth? Did he swear on the Bible? Because in his world, you spoke truth. And I thought about what, you know, when we finally came in and civilized these savages, what we brought with us. So I started to... Now, the reason I tell you those two stories is because what would happen is, as I would proceed to entertain each of these tasks of my work in India, it would take me back into all of these reflections, because I was living, they put me in a room in a small temple. The room was about quarter of this room. I had a mat on the floor, a table with for puja, for doing my religious things, a desk I could write on, a charcoal brazier for at night when it was really cold, a lota, a water pot, and that was it. That was it. Cement room. Right. Very cold. I had a blanket. My living regimen was up at around 6 usually. That was late. I mean, they were all up and away, but I was a Westerner, and they sort of let me slosh around in my own inefficiency. Off to the river with my lota for my morning snan or bath, which barefoot through the snow is quite an experience if you're not used to it. Then back for pranayama, for breathing, for asanas, then morning tea. Look at the river and drink the tea and read either the Bhagavad Gita or the Book of Tao. Meditate, reflect on it, and then I'd meditate for a few hours with some formal meditation. Haridas Baba would come in a couple of days a week at around 11:30 in the morning. He'd spend maybe a half hour, an hour teaching me. At around 1 o'clock, I would be given my meal for the day. It would be brought to the door, which was kedri, which is rice and dal, with dal is like a lentil mixed together, and sometimes sabji, a vegetable, which usually turned out to be potato or something like that. And I would say that food costs about 11 cents a day or something like that.